How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Welcome to a special edition of Chatter on Books. Thank you, Jamie, our part-time announcer. I am Claude, the full-time producer and editor, not part-time host. Just going to introduce this show. It's a special edition of Chatter on Books. Tori, David, and Jamie were at the Gaithersburg Book Festival interviewing Teresa Runstetler about her new book, Black Ball, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Spencer Haywood, and the Generation That Saved the Soul of the NBA. Enjoy.
Teresa, give us the backstory. Where are you from? Where did you grow up? What did you want to be when you were five?
I'm actually from Ontario, Canada, a city that you're probably not familiar with called Kitchener, Ontario. It's about the same distance as Baltimore to Washington, D.C., Kitchener to Toronto. So I'm just from over the border. I grew up my whole formative years in Ontario, came to the United States to go to graduate school. And that's really when I started to get interested in pursuing sports history more seriously when I was doing my PhD. So my first book was about Jack Johnson, right, the first ever Black world heavyweight champion, and looking at him as a global Black and anti-colonial icon. But I have other connections to the NBA in this story as well.
When you were a kid, though, were you a sports fan? Were you rock?
I was. So I look a little girly. I'm on the smaller side. My sport initially was figure skating, of all things. I think there's still a book to be written about figure skating and race. I kind of lived when I was a young kid, pursuing that and not really seeing anyone who looked like me reflected on the ice and wondering whether or not I belonged.
Wasn't there a French skater, a woman some years ago?
Saria Bonnelly.
Yeah. And she had a really rough time.
Correct? Yeah. And so, it's also a kind of sport that's super expensive. So that's part of the reason why I transitioned out of that and became a soccer player. And that was really my sport. But I also was a professional dancer when I was in university. Wow. I think I was a junior at that time. And somebody dared me to go to the Raptors Dance Pack audition. So if you know the Toronto Raptors, the NBA team, their dance team at the time, and this was 1996, the team had only been in existence for 1 year. And so I was like, sure, why not? So I went on a dare and ended up making it on the team.
Get out.
Yeah.
This should be on your bio on your book cover, by the way.
Well, it's in the introduction where I talk a little bit about how that experience as a dancer and getting to look behind the curtain of how the NBA spectacle actually unfolds on a nightly basis really gave me an idea of the kinds of decisions about labor and also about race and, in some ways, the management of Blackness. And at that time, in the late 90s, the management of hip-hop culture in the league, that really kind of gave me a little bit of an insight that I think the average person wouldn't necessarily have.
And your specialty in research really is race, labor, masculinity, sports, correct?
Yes.
And is that why you went to school in New York?
So I initially thought, let me get a PhD in the place where folks really know what they're talking about with respect to critical race theory.
Ooh. Wow.
Right? And I thought, then I'll go back to Canada because there's this huge gap in university offerings, at least in the late 90s, where you couldn't really study this stuff. So I really wanted to bring that curriculum back to Canada, but it takes a long time to get a PhD.
Yeah. It's one of the many reasons that thought, let's go get a PhD, has never occurred to me, Jamie, or David.
Ended up marrying an American, and so now I'm here, and I'm at American University.
Right, great school. Okay.
It took me five years to get my master's, so I don't think I'm going to live long enough for a PhD.
Okay, I've known Jamie and David for a long, long, long time. Either of you dance at all? Sober? David sings?
There's a difference between singing and being able to hold a note. I can hold a note that is not singing.
We're learning things all the time.
So this is all.
Oh, wait. I have a source on the outside who's telling me Jamie sings as well.
Just bad karaoke. But in my youth, I did dance in a dinner theater production of West Side Story.
Wow. Sharks or Jets?
The Marriott Twin Bridges in Northern Virginia. But because we had to learn.
The hotel closed down 40 years ago.
I know. Dates the whole thing. But I did get to throw women up in the air and catch them. And I learned some of the cool jet moves. So whenever I was forced to dance later in life, I would just revert to that because those are the only steps I knew.
Which jet were you?
Big Deal.
Big Deal.
Big
of
Deal.
Of course.
One of
the lesser known jets.
Because, when you're a jet, you're a jet all the way. Just saying.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Okay, Jamie McIntyre asked the question of our featured author, Teresa Ronstella.
Yeah, alluded to it, but the big question always is, what is the book about?
So, in a nutshell, and you're asking a historian who likes to give lectures that are 75 minutes long to give this in a nutshell.
Again, you're in the wrong tent.
Right. So, I wanted to look at how African-American ball players really transformed professional basketball in the 1970s. Roughly from 1967 up to the days of Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. Because it's a period of time in NBA history and professional basketball history that hasn't really been talked about. And I think also, too, it's been largely mischaracterized as this kind of flyover period, that nothing interesting happened in, with the exception of maybe Dr. J and, some of the other stars from that era. But there was so much labor activism going on in this period, so many important fights that really transformed the relationship between players and team owners in this period. Also, too, basketball players transformed the way that the sport was played. And of course, they weren't necessarily embraced for all of these things. So I found that a lot of that negative press about particularly the late 1970s, which people often talk about as the so-called dark ages of the NBA, was actually a racial narrative about the changing face of basketball.
So, David, you were a bit of a youngster in that era. Have you ever looked back at that era?
Sure. And it's one of my main kind of discussion points with people who talk about the history of the NBA as if it's this monolith, and it's actually a series of waves. If you look at it, starting in the very beginnings in the 50s and in the 60s, you had people like Bill Russell, Oscar Robertson, Elgin Baylor, really kind of being vanguards for racial progress, really demanding equal treatment that they did not receive, literally had to stay in a different hotel from their teammates. And some teams reacted well to that and some teams didn't, right? So, but as Teresa writes in her book, the 70s were another wave where you have this kind of all of these firsts, like Wayne Embry becoming the first black GM for the Milwaukee Bucks. And Wayne is a dear friend of mine I've known for about 30 years. And he's...
Who also had a connection to the Toronto Raptors.
Sure, he still is an advisor to them. And there was this wave in the 70s, and I continually point this out to people because people will say, we're tired of the same team winning the championship all the time. We want different teams winning championships. Well, the NBA, 8 different teams won championships in 10 years. And nobody cared. In fact, they did. It was so poorly received by the fans that the NBA Finals, the championship series, was shown on tape delay. It didn't come on until 11:30 at night on the East Coast. You had to literally not watch the news if you wanted to watch the game and not know who won already. So that is endemic of what Teresa writes about in the book, which is that era was really almost purposely, it seemed, kind of denigrated and panned as not being at all interesting. And then if you look at the people that won titles in that era, you know, you had Lenny Wilkins, who was at the time the second black head coach ever to win an NBA championship with the Seattle Supersonics. And you had Earl Monroe, and you had Walt Frazier win championships, and Willis Reed won championships. And Dr. J was in the finals, you know, and Wes Unseld, who we all know here, the great, late, great Wes Unseld won a championship with the Bullets. So there was there were enormous talents in the NBA in the 70s, but they were all kind of shunned to the side. As David Stern famously said, we were viewed as too black.
Right.
The league was too black.
Right.
And people, and everybody was on drugs. And you write about that as well.
Yeah, Teresa, talk, I mean, there's such, and I did not know of this article, but there was an article by Chris Cobbs of the LA Times, 1980? Talk infamous. About the article and the influence it has, but you have to explain the article a little bit.
Yeah, so Chris Cobbs, a reporter with the LA Times, wrote this article that I kept seeing over and over again in descriptions of the period. Came out in August 1980, and it basically stated that between 40 and 75% of players in the National Basketball League were using drugs, and that at least 10% were doing freebase. Which, this is in the days before crack cocaine. We're talking about powder cocaine. And, you know, for folks who are old enough to know this, powder cocaine at the time in the 1980s was considered a white drug. It was a status drug. It was considered to be the drug of, you know, white professionals, the jet set, et cetera. So the fact that these young black ball players who, you know, just for reason of their athletic talent had gotten a hold of this drug and were now abusing it. And this was the implication, was that they couldn't trust them, that they were criminal, that they had to have security on them at all times in order to manage them, or else this was going to be a major public relations disaster for the NBA. This article has really become the almost the touchstone for this 1970s narrative of decline in the NBA. And for me, when I was looking at that, I couldn't help but connect that to this larger demographic and aesthetic change going on in professional basketball, where the league not only got blacker in terms of the players, it went from being 58% black in the 1960s to being 75% black, with most of the starting five of many teams being African-American as well. And then also the style of play had radically transformed, in large part because black players were taking the style that was honed on the playground courts in their neighborhoods and were bringing it onto the big stage with the pros. And so I couldn't help but see that article as a commentary on this racial power struggle that was going on in the league and I think society at large during the 1970s.
And it's a little horrifying how many in the media picked up that article, picked up that theme, and ran with it for a long time.
And took the 40% off and just...
Right, 75%.
Just went with 75%.
Right. Well,
with no real factual basis for those numbers, by the way.
Total. Yeah.
So if I could follow up on my original question about what the book's about. Sure. The subtitle of your book, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Spencer Haywood, and the generation that saved the soul of the NBA. How so? Explain.
So, okay, the dirty little secret is that I didn't come up with that subtitle.
Authors never do.
We never do. I came up with the initial title.
No. Tortured people at publishing houses who think if they come up with the perfect subtitle, they'll sell millions of more copies.
Right. It's all about search engine optimization. Put those names in there.
Yeah.
You know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was not that happy that he was mentioned in the subtitle. So
you heard from him?
Well, his lawyer.
Oh. Great.
We actually had to take him off the cover and replace him with Spencer Haywood. And Spencer Haywood is all about getting promoted, so he had absolutely no problem with that.
Shocking to hear.
Shocking, right?
I love Spencer.
A fantastic guy. Again, another you know, even though he's starting to get his due now, is somewhat of a hidden figure in NBA history.
There's a great book by my contemporaries, Mark Spears and Gary Washburn, about Spencer Haywood, about the Spencer Haywood case, if you ever want to read it. So.
Yeah, absolutely. But in terms of, I mean, I think I originally had the struggle for the soul of basketball. So the idea was that, you know, the very nature of professional basketball, what type of sport it would be in terms of labor relations, what type of sport it would be in terms of style, what type of sport it would be in terms of its racial breakdown, all of that was being struggled over in the 1970s. And of course, this is during the Soul era. This is during, you know, the height of Black popular culture, and the players were bringing that kind of soul, Black masculine identity to a huge stage through their basketball. And so I think that, you know, if we think of the NBA as being a more progressive league, and actually that was always what folks would say to me when I first started doing the book, but they'd be like, oh, but it's so progressive. And
they're thinking about the last few years.
Right. In some respects, but I mean, where's the bar? Is the bar the NFL? Right? Or hockey. And I'm very familiar with hockey's politics. But you know, they were there to really set it on a trajectory that I think helped to turn it into a global sports property. You know, David Stern had something to do with that, but I think all of those battles that the players fought over in the early 70s in bringing light to the horrendous practice of blacklisting or blackballing of players through the Connie Hawkins case, Spencer Haywood's case, which brought down the four-year rule, which was a violation of antitrust law, Oscar Robertson et al. V. the NBA, another antitrust case that brought down the reserve clause and opened the door to unrestricted free agency. All of these things were part of the NBA's monopolistic business practices that were designed to keep the players' compensation low and to maintain control over them. So I think the free-flowing game, the game where the players are able to exercise more agency, both on the court and off the court, that's the soul of the NBA. So if the NBA is progressive now in terms of its, you know, political stance with respect to Black Lives Matter, or, you know, the kinds of contracts that it offers, protections, health, care, guaranteed contracts, et cetera, that's the soul of the NBA, and it's really Black players who are instrumental.
So when you all go out to the building after this to buy your copies of Teresa's book, are you going to be there for signings afterwards?
Yeah.
Just take a Sharpie and get rid of that subtitle and put in hers, because I think
just
it's
right in Dr.
No,
J.
I think it's a great, I have to say, you know, I'm not good at coming up with titles. No. I write the content, but I think they came up with a way of encapsulating really that struggle.
Did the Spencer, and I'll throw this to you as well, David, did the Spencer Haywoods, did the Robertsons at the time, did they realize what they were doing would have greater impacts beyond their careers? Or were they just trying to get from week to week and get paid
Spencer
fairly?
Spencer was trying to play. He wanted to play.
Yeah.
You know, he had signed with an ABA team, and then he signed with an NBA team, and he just wanted an opportunity to play. I mean, Spencer is an amazing individual. He came from a very small town called Silver City, Mississippi, where they were literally sharecroppers in the 50s and 60s. And was one of the few players that actually played in the 1968 Olympics, when most of the African-American players at the Bass, Harry Edwards, who had organized a boycott of the Olympic Games, Spencer played and was the best player in the world by far. And so when he just wanted to play. I think Oscar's situation was more global. He understood that there was a problem. And I think at the time, as you guys know, there was another league called the ABA that was offering lots of money to players to come play for the ABA instead of the NBA.
Allegedly lots of money.
It was always kind of ish.
Promise, but then it wasn't there.
It's a great story. It would take way too long about guys from the ABA literally taking their checks and running to the bank within seconds of getting the checks to make sure they could get cashed. But yes, but that was more about making sure that there were opportunities for players to go play and pit the leagues against each other, basically, to try to get more money, which is perfectly understandable. And the irony is that the league, the lawsuit was settled in 1966, or 1976, exactly when the merger occurred between the two leagues.
Yeah, and that was actually one of the requirements of the merger, for the merger to go through and not be contested. They had to get rid of the reserve clause. That and that was actually the genius of the players, you know, led by Oscar Robertson and others. They basically said, listen, we're going to F up your merger until you comply with these demands. Because for them, you know, the reserve clause, they couldn't help but see it as another form of economic bondage. Because the reserve clause basically tied you to one team once you signed with them for the entirety of your career, unless the team decided to dispense with you. Even after your contract expired, you were still, quote unquote, the property of that team. So folks coming up, you know, who had literally been sharecroppers growing up, or, you know, had family members who had been in bondage, right? They understood that this was not just about professional basketball, but this was about, you know, them getting their economic rights as full citizens in the United States.
Let's go back to the drugs, which is something you always want to hear at session.
No, one of the things that struck me, and Jamie, you were working as a journalist in Washington late 70s, early 80s, right?
Right.
Reagan's war on drugs was a very big deal. And one of the things that struck me when I was reading this piece was those who would write about cocaine use in the NBA treated them as though they were the only ones doing it. And I was in the horse world, and there was a lot of cocaine use in the horse world. My sister was in the entertainment business. There was a lot of it was everywhere. It was absolutely everywhere. So the singling out of them. But Jamie, I'm trying to remember with Reagan, the war on drugs, and Nancy Reagan, Just Say No, those kinds of things. Did they get wrapped up in the sports side of things, or was it just a general blanket, don't do drugs?
Well, I think it was pretty much everywhere. This, you know, this the don't say no thing, and of course the hypocrisy of that was that there were many, many people, as you mentioned, particularly affluent people. I can remember a friend of mine revealing to me that she used cocaine and that she took it with her when she went on vacation. And I was like, you know, are you crazy? What if you get arrested? What if you get stopped? I mean, why would you do that? And she wasn't worried about it because she was a very high profile, you know, semi-famous individual, and she just didn't think it would ever be a problem for her.
I at maybe age two, so I'm not dating myself, I worked briefly at the Department of Justice. Worst job I've ever had. I've had nothing but great jobs, the worst 6 months of my life. And I worked on this thing called the President's Initiative on Organized Crime and Narcotics Trafficking. It was designed to investigate, prosecute, and ultimately cripple organized crime. I remember our line. And it was started by two of Reagan's speechwriters. 1981, recession. They said he needs something to run on. He needs something to be for. He needs to be tough on crime. And they came up with the President's Initiative on Organized Crime and Narcotics Trafficking. And I remember being about 3 months into it. I was essentially a research assistant. 3 months into it going, this is a complete fraud. This is terrible. But it was actually the launch pad for Rudy Giuliani. Take that for what it's worth.
But neither of those initiatives worked out.
Neither one of them worked out. No, that initiative was all about, we're going down a rabbit hole. Was a lot about interdicting drugs at the border. And if you devote all your time and energy and your boats and your cops and everybody to interdicting drugs in Florida, coming to Florida, guess what? Oh, we're going to go to Louisiana. We're going to go to Texas. And it moves on.
Well, this just makes me think of a moment that I talk about in the book in the early 1970s where a Senate subcommittee looked into the proper and improper use of drugs in sports. Now, this was supposed to be about performance-enhancing drugs.
Sure.
But what I found so intriguing, and I'm going to write an article on this. It didn't make it into the book. What became so interesting is that with Black-dominated sports like basketball, they were able to flip the script so cleverly, the leagues, team owners, to focus on illicit street drug use by players without stepping back and saying, oh, actually, and the players pointed this out, the trainers are the ones who are the biggest drug dealers in the sports industry, and they are the ones at the time in the early 70s giving us all of these uppers, these amphetamines. They are shooting us up with, you know, all sorts of steroids in order to, you know, reduce inflammation so you can get right back on the court or the field again.
Yeah.
And so it was really interesting, the concerted efforts of the powers that be in sports to really flip the culpability in terms of that conversation back onto the individual athletes and to really cultivate this narrative of, you know, alleged criminality or, you know,
ascribing it to player behavior.
Right.
Instead of team management.
Team management. And also the fact that the players were pointing out, look, you've got us, you know, going from city to city to city. We need, you know, something to help us bring us down after a game to get us up. We're almost being asked to do superhuman things, and yet you want us to do that, you know, with human bodies, and that there was this growing disconnect with the demands of professional sport and the human limits of our bodies.
Well, this gets back to the wave nature of the NBA, specifically in sports in general, which if you think back to 1997, 98, when there was a collective bargaining agreement and the NBA went to great pains to make it all about penalizing marijuana use. Yeah. We're going to get rid of marijuana. It's a terrible gateway drug. We use the phrase all the time, gateway drug. And now in 2023, marijuana is basically going to be legal now. You don't get penalized for using it because it goes in waves. And so
I think they also see a marketing opportunity in that to get in on the ground floor as it becomes.
Wait, is John Boehner involved in a marijuana company? Oh, yeah, he is. That's right.
Okay, this is a Washington crowd. Who remembers Jack Kemp? Right? Look at all his hands. I love DMV crowds. Buffalo Bills, right? 70s?
Yeah.
70s.
Late 60s or early 70s, yeah.
Most of you have forgotten this. Jack Kemp briefly ran for vice president.
Very good.
Under Bob Dole. And I was on the team that was going to get Jack Kemp ready to run for vice president. And we sit down with him getting ready for his first press conference and just going through all the usual stupid questions. And I'm just like, ticking through them. And I said, okay, have you ever done drugs? And he goes, no. And I don't even look up. And he goes, well, what kind? And my head snaps up. This is not a good sign. And he talked, Teresa, I mean, that he sounded, it was years ago, but Sandra, almost exactly like you. And his situation was further complicated. Shows you how much he loved football. He was a Christian Scientist. So not big on medicine and science and things like that. Family never took any drugs of any kind. And he said it was a personal challenge, struggle for him. But he said, you play and you realize, he said almost exactly those things, what you had to do to get up and high enough to get creamed on the field and then to come down after it.
I hate to break it to you all, but nothing much has changed in the NFL.
Yeah. Just do you remember Ray Shunke? Anybody remember Ray Shunke? Played for the team was then called the Redskins.
Correct.
He told us a story once, my husband knew him, that in the off season they'd always try to get clean, essentially, because they knew it was not good for them over the long run. And they were always talking to each other in the off season, no, we're not going to do it, we're not going to do it. And then they'd be getting ready, and it's time to go on the field for the first game. They'd go, oh, bleep, and they'd run off to the trainers and get help. Which sport does the most performance enhancing?
All of them. I mean, in different regards. I mean, obviously, in baseball, everybody talks about steroids, but
sure,
baseball has a ridiculous history with drugs and greenies and uppers and downers and things like that they've had forever. And with basketball, I swear to God, nobody denies it. But you would see players taking anti-inflammatories by the handful. Mm. You sure. And Shaq has talked about his stomach is destroyed,
right?
Because he had to take dozens of painkillers.
Well, he's
just
a big
to
guy.
Play.
He's a very big guy.
Well, that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of pain centers. So yeah, and nothing nothing has really changed. They're all, it's to your point, it's impossible to be a professional athlete.
Right, and not do it.
And not do it. I just don't think it's possible.
So, Teresa, something you said made me think of this about other things you want to write about. And I think this is a fascinating topic. But you're a research superstar. What was your approach for this book? And did you learn things that you wanted to include but just didn't fit? What's your research approach? Alma Katsu was speaking earlier, a wonderful author in the CIA for 30 years. She writes great books. Red London is out now. Go get it. But she talks about she has to work very hard not to get research paralysis. You know, she has to be very careful because it's so easy to just start digging down. But what's your approach to research? And did you learn something that you thought was fascinating, but it's just not right for this book?
I mean, there were a lot of things that actually are on the cutting room floor, mm-hmm. just because, you know, we wanted to maintain the tightness of the narrative.
Sure.
One of the things that shocked me when I was doing my research was just how many people were essentially holding out before the season started as the one way that they could try and leverage some power with the team owners to renegotiate a contract, and how consistently the mainstream media would paint them as greedy, as a troublemaker, as ungrateful. And this narrative just kept happening over and over again. So I cherry picked the three antitrust cases to really focus on in the first part of the book. But underneath that were more antitrust cases and more, you know, players really trying whatever strategy they could to improve their situation. And we often think about, you know, activism in sports as being just things like
social.
Colin Kaepernick taking a knee. That's absolutely part of it. But the other part, and I think this is why the 70s have perhaps been painted as a time when there was little to no activism among athletes, was that they were focused on improving the situation in terms of their labor rights within professional sports. And that actually needs to be recognized as an important contribution.
Let's start with Curt Flood. I mean, Curt Flood was the first one, right? And he lost. People forget Curt Flood lost his case to the U.S. Supreme Court to strike down the reserve clause in baseball. Now, ultimately, and as you point out in your book, Andy Messersmith, I always forget the other guy's name, they got free agency in 1975 because an arbitrator said, no, they are allowed to be free agents. They can sign whatever they want to. But it wasn't the case that everybody remembers, which is Curt Flood when he was here in Washington with the senators saying, I have the right. When my contract expires, I should be able to sign with whoever I want. And that way, you're exactly right. The 70s were incredibly litigious across the board in sports, with players trying to assert in their unions, starting to have successes, real successes in asserting the power of the union to negotiate in good faith and to negotiate on behalf of the players.
What are the this is for both of you. And Jamie, I know this is your specialty, so just jump in. You're dying to jump in. Similarities and differences with the negotiations of the last few years for college athletes and high school getting to get paid for their name, image, and likeness.
Yeah, cyclical. You know, that's the O'Bannon case. Ed O'Bannon, who played at UCLA, said, you guys are making millions. Well, you're selling jerseys with my name on them. I should get a cut of that. And then they went, get out of here. And he took them to court and won. And so now you see the whole world is all about NIL now. That this is because, again, the kind of, the offshoot of the professional athletes kind of standing up and asserting themselves. Now you're seeing college athletes.
Sure.
You're seeing
high school.
You saw 2 years ago, I'm bad with names because I'm old now, the student athlete, I believe she played at Stanford during the Final Four or during the tournament, saying, getting out her phone and showing them what passed for the women's, you know.
Oh, right, the locker room.
Locker room.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
You know, what their weight room was compared to the men's.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, this is bullshit. Like, this is, you'll see what the men get and what we get. And now, guess what? Everybody gets the same. Because people stand up.
There's a 15-year-old daughter of Patrick Ewing, who's a volleyball player in the area, high school, obviously. And she just signed a very small deal, but she just signed a deal. And I heard an interview with her, and she just said, if they're going to make money off me, mm-hmm. and I get to make money off this. It makes all the sense in the world. Okay, let me get you out with one question, and then we'll take questions from the audience, and we have a little chatter on books work we need to do at the end. Who did you not get to meet or interview that you'd like to have?
Kareem.
Yeah.
But he's kind of got a fortress around him. Yeah.
Kareem doesn't talk.
No.
Except for money. Now.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah, it's true.
But, you know, on a certain level, I shouldn't be surprised because I looked at the history of his relationship with journalists and folks who wanted to talk with him in the early 70s, and it wasn't a good one.
But he's done so many other things, and he's had to. The return on investment, just not there.
And he's got a terrific Substack now.
Yeah, absolutely.
He really does. He talks about politics and music and sports. It's really quite
very
good.
Interesting.
He's a really good writer.
But I do have to say, I was teaching a course a few years ago, and I mentioned Kareem Abdul-Jabbar with respect to the revolt of the black athlete, activism in the late 1960s among black athletes, and my students hadn't heard of him.
Wow.
Oh, the knife went in and it turned. I couldn't believe it. But I think he came back into view recently because LeBron beat his scoring record.
Oh, right,
now he's more sort of in the news cycle. But at that time, they didn't know him.
Mm. Yeah. Give them all Fs. Yeah.
If only I could.
Yeah, you can't anymore.
We're late, Claire. It's okay. You're trying to sneak in.
Hi, Claire.
But I see you. You're late.
I came for Vermont. Any questions from the audience? Yes, sir. I'm back. You can yell it. We'll repeat it.
What do you think are still the hurdles that are still left that we really have fully, evenly?
There's one black owner in the NBA. His name is Michael Jordan. You shouldn't have to be Michael Jordan to own an NBA team. There are very few, almost no black doctors, team physicians, very few black head athletic trainers. There are very few black people who run, who are CEOs on the business side. So that next journey is in the NBA. The next place where activism may lead to results is in those areas. Coaching kind of goes up and down. A few years ago, the numbers were getting really low. They got down to 7. Now it's back up to about 15 or 16. It's down now to 13 because a couple got fired. So there's five vacancies right now. So depending on who fills them. But I would say the front office's ownership, to me, is where it is. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, another story that really surprised me when I was doing the research for this book was that there actually was a black man in the front, in the league offices back in the 70s. And, whenever I tell this story about Simon Gourdin, kind of like, I never heard of this guy. Like, how did that happen? And he was actually the highest ranking black official in sports management.
Wow.
In all of North America. And this guy's story has, so seldomly been told. And he was not actually a former athlete. He was somebody who came up through, the traditional college route, ended up being trained as a lawyer, was a corporate lawyer at first, specializing in antitrust law. So they brought him in under Walter Kennedy, who was the commissioner back in the 70s. And at one point, he made it all the way up to being deputy commissioner for Walter Kennedy. And he seemed as if he might be the heir apparent. But then they ended up hiring Larry O'Brien as the next commissioner because he was white, and he also had a lot of political connections in D.C., and they wanted to make sure that they got that merger through. So I think absolutely the front offices, in terms of the NBA league offices, I think in terms of what you were talking about with the dress code and the like, I mean, I came up, my days at the Toronto Raptors were during Allen Iverson's heyday. And we loved Allen Iverson because for us, he represented everything that was beautifully transgressive about hip hop. And so I think that, it's always this push and pull with the NBA. The players will, push that mandate of, the NBA trying to sell a particular version of blackness to its fullest extent, and then they come up against a wall, and then they sort of have to negotiate it back. And I think that, you know, now that the players have so much unmediated access to their fans through social media, they've become brands in and of themselves. The NBPA has a lot of power. They're actually able to stand in front of, you know, Adam Silver and say, well, we actually want to have Black Lives Matter on our jerseys.
Yeah.
And be able to actually have that happen. But it's always this constant negotiation.
Negotiation, but as an amateur watching this, I think the players are leading the charge and management's trying to catch up for what a shock. They can make more money. I mean, these individual players are big brands. Yes, sir.
For the benefit of our Chatter on Books audience, can you come up here and I'll hold the mic for you?
Oh, thank you, Jamie. What a guy.
Can you step up here? If you have questions, just come on.
Okay. How many players and coaches did you interview, and were they, other than Kareem, were they pretty much all cooperative?
So I did this book during the pandemic with a young child at home. No child care for much of it. So instead of, I had all these plans to do a ton of interviews, but with the pandemic and, you know, having to work between the hours of 4 and 7 every day, what I did, which is what I do best as a historian, I dug and I found every possible interview that they did when they were 20 years old. So, and a lot of it is out there. A lot of it is digitized now. A wonderful source at the time was Black Sports Magazine, in existence from 1971 to 1978. It was a Black-owned, Black-run, Black sports magazine specifically for a Black audience. They had many extended, what they called rap sessions with players, right? And because the mainstream white media was not asking them about labor politics. It wasn't asking them about, you know, their aspirations after basketball. But you could find this in Black independent media. You could find this in Black newspapers. And it was almost like there were two conversations happening.
Sure.
One in Black media and one in mainstream media.
Can I take it back to the DMV really quickly?
Absolutely.
So 78, 79, and or 77, 78, the Washington franchise was in the finals back-to-back, actually 1-1.
78 and 79.
Yep, sir. West Unsell, the Biggie,
yep.
Bobby Dandridge. How does that factor into this narrative? Because that was right at the cusp of when Larry and Magic came into the league, but you had these very different teams that were in smaller markets. So go ahead.
Well, I mean, Teresa writes about it in the book when the Bullets played the Warriors 3 years before they played they played the Sonics twice, that was the first time that two Black coaches had played each other in the championship series in the NBA. So it was Al Attles, who's a Hall of Famer from Golden State, and Casey Jones, Hall of Famer for Washington. But that franchise that wound up getting swept famously by Golden State, it's essentially the same franchise with Bobby Dandridge that won the championship 3 years later. So, I mean, they were a powerhouse again. Nobody remembers this. The Bullets went to the finals 4 times in the 1970s. They were one of the two or three best teams in the entire league, which is why I get angry. One was in Baltimore. This is why I get angry with the current ownership, because they act like, this is just like any other. No, the last time this franchise won 50 games was in 1979. I was 14. Okay, so, but the genius of that franchise was in that 75 team.
And I think so much of that was overshadowed by the fact that there were all of these other quote-unquote crises going on in the sport. And then also, too, we forget that basketball was still largely a local or regional sport. It didn't have a national media presence in the same way that it does now.
Very much so. Last question, then we have a little Chatter business to do.
Quick question. The show me the money rule, basically, is what I'm wondering about. How many Blacks are being agents or are in the, you know, in the union? I remember Gene Upshaw, but he's the only one I can think of.
You mean now or then?
I mean, now.
Well, now the head of the NBA Players Association, she just got the job a couple of years ago. She's the second black woman to run the NBA after Michelle Roberts. So there's real progress in that. There's a number of black agents, prominent black agents in sports. But there are still many more white agents than there are black agents. Although there are a half dozen or so very, very prominent black agents in the sport. So it's cyclical.
And I would also say there's this wonderful critique in Black Sports Magazine by Jesse Jackson in the 70s, where he talks about vertical segregation in sport. So if you look at if you follow the money up the pyramid, the whiter it gets. And so it has this impact of having, you know, the folks who are on the field, the quote unquote gladiators, the ones who are doing the physical work, the ones who are putting on this kind of racialized spectacle are predominantly black. But the folks who are garnering all of the money are still largely white. Yeah.
Okay, now a really good interviewer would end the session on that really profound comment. I are not. So we're going to subject this really smart, talented author to what we do on Chatter on Books with really good authors, something we call 60 Seconds More. But David and Jamie, I'm going to share it with you, okay? So
go right ahead.
Don't let Teresa see this. Pass that down to Jamie.
Okay.
Chris.
You don't.
And then you get
watch
yours.
This, and then I get mine.
I'll okay. do one. You do two. You do three, Jamie, okay. And then four, five, six. Okay. I'm going to go first. Teresa, favorite childhood book?
Oh gosh, anything by Judy Blume.
Oh, happy anniversary!
I
yeah,
Judy Blume.
Pretty fabulous.
Okay. Name a writer that has influenced you.
Probably somebody a little bit more obscure to this audience, but Robin D.G. Kelly, who is a famous historian.
Yeah.
Oh, yes!
Yeah.
Amazing so author, great. Somebody who is able to take complex, abstract ideas and make them make sense in regular language, and I aspire to that.
You're very close, Jamie.
What do you wish more people would write about?
Oh, geez. I feel like there's room for more books in the field of sport history that come in it with an African-American studies perspective.
What? We're waiting for David Aldridge to write a
like with stuff. All of the history and the context, and not just about personalities, but really looking at the structure of the sporting business, you know, the racial dimensions of it. I feel like there's still so much that could be done.
Yeah.
In that
you're young,
realm.
You can do it. Okay. What's your
I'm
writing?
Not that young.
What is your personal writing scenario? Where are you? What are you wearing? And do you have snacks?
Snacks, of course. Of course. So I'm a ritualistic writer. I have an office I live in an old brownstone office on the third floor. I've got my aromatherapy going because the
nice.
Scent is key. Preferably lavender and some form of peppermint. I actually listen to instrumental house music.
Wow.
And yeah, I can't concentrate with, you know, words. So it has to be instrumental. Yeah. Otherwise I get distracted.
Need noise. Okay. Ask my wife.
And you know, I once I'm in that zone and I've got a good bougie coffee, you can't stop me. You can't stop me.
This is my daughter's spirit animal here, people. David?
You can have dinner with any three athletes, dead or alive. Who are they?
Dead or alive. Okay, Serena Williams.
Good one.
Okay.
Good one.
I will say Kareem again.
The Holy Grail.
You're going to pay him to come to dinner?
Oh, geez, a third one.
Ted Williams?
Ted Williams?
Yeah. Isn't his head somewhere? Couldn't we get his head somewhere? Yeah.
So somebody who I'm thinking about writing on, Ora Washington. So she was like Serena before Serena.
Oh, good one. Okay.
You know, two-sport athlete, basketball, tennis, amazing athlete in the 1930s. I would love to.
So many book pick her
potential
brain.
For you.
Okay, yeah. Jamie, last one.
Okay, so you're going to a desert island for the rest of your life by yourself, and you can only take one book, what is it?
I will say the book that really spoke to my teenage heart, Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, blew my mind and I think sort of set me on the trajectory to what I do now.
Nice, and it holds up well. Okay, a book that will hold up very well by Teresa Runsettler, Black Ball. It is fantastic, people.
Thank you so much.
Thank Jamie, David, Teresa, thank you so much. So this morning, getting ready for this, I thought to myself, I want to find something really nice to say about the Gaithersburg Book Festival because it's so extraordinary. So like my dear friend Jamie does, I went to ChatGPT. And before I had finished, what are nice things to say about the Gaithersburg Book Festival? It spit out this. I had to stop it because it was spitting out more answers. But there are some really, really good ones. But the last one, the Gaithersburg Book Festival is not just an event. It's a lawnmower.
It's the van. That's it's exactly. The van.
It's a golf cart. Okay, the Gaithersburg Book Festival is not just an event, but a celebration of the power of words, creativity, and storytelling, leaving a lasting impact on everyone who attends. So thank you for attending. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, GPT, for taking our jobs. Thank you.